Thank you for tuning in to our latest episode of Twin Souls, a Best Friends podcast. We hope you enjoy our Murder, Mystery, and Mayhem series, and we plan to bring our listeners even more content in the future. We tell you all about ourselves, our lives, and our stories, and somewhere in between, we get into tough and sometimes funny or sexy topics. Stay tuned for more episodes from us at Twin Souls Podcast.
Welcome, everybody, to our new episode of our Murder, Mystery, and Mayhem edition. I am Jordan, and I am actually here today to tell you a story that I researched and stumbled upon, and I hope you all enjoy. Sometimes there are killers out there whose crimes go unnoticed. They use various means to hide their identity and hide their victims. Today, in part one, we'll be chatting about Israel Keyes, one of the most prolific and unknown serial killers in the United States of America. The details of all his crimes are truly unknown. This man gave enough information as he deemed fit. He ruined lives, tormented, tortured, and even raped his victims. His crimes and victims are only known because he decided to divulge that information. Basically, he played games. He was sick, sadistic, smart, and clever. However, he had a rage that was built up inside him that just roared out. Israel went to great details and great depths to plan and execute each of his murder and also his additional crimes that he got into. Today, in this first part, we'll be going into details about his early life, as well touch upon briefly his army, and then finally Alaska. In Alaska, we will go to the murder, his final murder, which is Samantha Koenig. He has what is known to be less than 12 victims. What that means is truly unknown because he mentions less than 12 quite often and about multiple different topics. Israel is known to be extremely meticulous. He often traveled thousands of miles to commit his crimes, and he was also known to create kill kits. These kill kits basically had everything you needed to kill, dispose, and safely hide a body. He placed these multiple ones. We have no idea how many all throughout the United States.
Keyes was very meticulous. His crimes were very well thought out. There was nothing that was spur of the moment or, just kind of went out one day and decided to do something. Everything was meticulously planned. And our interviews with him were the same from his standpoint. I mean, I never got the sense that he, accidentally told us something or got angry and riled up and then something flew out of his mouth. My sense was that he knew every time he came in kind of what he was going to give us that day.
Israel Keyes was born January 7th, 1978 in Cove, Utah to Heidi and John Jeffrey Keyes. He was the second child of 10. The thing is, I've read multiple articles that said he was the second youngest of 10, but also the second oldest of 10. So I'm not exactly sure where he fell in the line of that. Basically, when Israel Keyes was 4 years old, his family moved the whole group of 10 to the woods outside of Colville, Washington. There, the family lived in isolation, in the woods without heat nor electricity. In the woods, the Keyes children kept work. In the woods, the Keyes children kept to work living in tents. The boys hunted for food in the woods. Israel often built several cabins throughout his teen years. During this time, Israel actually began to notice how different he was from other people. He learned that he had to be more careful. He also began to notice how different he was from other people. In Washington, the family joined a white supremacist church group, also known as the ARC. It was here where he met Chevy and Shane Kehoe. If you Google these two, Chevy and Shane, they are two white supremacist terrorists. They are brothers and are currently in prison for murder. Together, these three would often steal guns. Israel would often also break into the neighbors' homes. He stole money, and he also frequently tortured animals and enjoyed it. When he was stealing the guns, he actually was caught by a few of the neighbors, and they obviously weren't that happy. One example of his torturous ways was when he was 14. He apparently tied up a cat to a tree with a parachute cord and shot it in the stomach and watched as the cat ran around and around.
I've known since I was 14 that there were things that I thought were normal and that were okay that nobody else seems to think are normal and okay.
Yeah.
When I was 14, there were some friends staying with us, and there was a cat of ours that was always getting into the trash, and it was my sister's cat, and I told her at the time, I was like, if that cat gets into the trash again, I'm gonna kill it. And so there was this kid and some of his, I think maybe one of my sisters and one of his sisters, we all went up into the woods and I had the cat with me. And took a piece of parachute cord and tied it to this tree. The parachute cord was about 10 feet long and I had a .22 revolver with me. And I shot it in the stomach and it ran around and around the tree and then like, crashed into the tree and then started vomiting. And as soon as that, like for me, I didn't really react. I mean, I actually kind of laughed a little, I think, because of the way it was running around the tree. But then I looked over at everybody else and the kid who was about my age was with me. He was throwing up, like he was like really, I don't know, traumatized, I guess you would say. And he told his dad about it. And then, of course his dad talked to my parents about it. And that was pretty much the last time anybody went in the woods with me. I learned my lesson.
He's explaining that with pretty good details and he's like laughing about it as well. He's enjoying it. He's enjoying retelling the story all over again.
I feel like people should see my face right now to understand what you're doing.
Right? Right?
You're trying to make it make sense to me.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know what to say. By the way, Kelsey just jumped in. If everyone's wondering why her voice just showed up randomly, that's why.
Hi. Wow.
Right? But like in his.
That makes me really hate him though.
Yes. Yes. But the thing is, that's one of the. I forget. Isn't there like a specific name for the four things a lot of serial killers do? Have in common, and that's one of them, torture of animals.
That is one of them. I know, like characteristics, you mean?
Yes, it's like peeing the bed, torture of animals. I know that.
Being molested.
Two, something like that.
Yeah, I know what you're talking. Like the same kind of childhood upbringing, the same characteristics of each other. They did the same things.
Exactly. So basically during this time when Israel was 14 up until the age of about 17, he lived in the same place in Washington State. Shortly before his family decided to move to a new town in Maupin, Oregon, he actually robbed his first bank. So he says he was approximately about 17 or so when this actually happened. After the whole family moved to Oregon, he actually began to distance himself from the church and he became curious with Satanism and actually started like worshiping and thinking about taking it to the next level. And then basically that summer he did take it to the next level.
Oh God, I don't know if I'm ready for this. Whew.
When I was living in Oregon, I was working on this house for my dad, and there was this river that was near the house. There was a lot of people would go down there, a pretty remote area, but there were beaches and stuff along the river where people would go and hang out for the day and stuff, and that's, I don't know, that's what gave me the idea, I guess. There, you know, there would be people hanging on the beaches, you know, like younger girls in their swimsuits and stuff, and I think I was only maybe 18 at the time.
So did you get away with something there?
Yeah. Never even got reported. I mean, I didn't... Like I said, I didn't have the nerve to, you know, take it to the next level, but... But in my mind, that's what I was gonna do.
Is it a pretty remote area that you were in?
Yeah. It's called the Deschutes River. It goes into the Columbia. It's like just a little town out in the middle of nowhere, but in the summertime there were a lot of people who would go up there from Portland and stuff. And
yeah, what, I've been to that area. What's the name of the towns there?
Well, the town that the house I was working on was in was Maupin. It's just downriver from Bend, I think. Yeah, Bend, Oregon.
And what did you do then? You said you thought about taking it to the next level, but you obviously did some level.
Something you got away with.
Yeah. Oh, there were these remote restrooms in these just random little beach areas along the river. And I took somebody to one of those, but I didn't kill her.
What'd you do to her? Was that the first time you sexually assaulted somebody?
Depends what your definition is.
Is that the first time you had sex with somebody against their will?
No, but...
So I seen the look on your face, so yeah, right? It depends on what your opinion on sexual assault is.
And then he laughs.
Right?
Like, I've never wanted to punch somebody in the face more.
Right?
You know what I mean?
I know exactly what you mean. And he does this quite often throughout a lot of the interviews.
Oh my God, it's like he has no soul. That's what it feels like.
Exactly. So let's see what else he has to say about this.
That was the first time I took it to that level and like had someone tied up, you know, like was ready to actually
kill,
do that. Yeah.
What did that feel like?
I mean, I had it all planned out. It was, you know, that was my intention.
Was to rape her and kill her?
Yeah, it was a small bathroom. It didn't get used very much. They probably only cleaned it out maybe once a year or something, so.
Permanent type bathroom or a rent-a-can type bathroom?
Like a permanent, like the ones you see at Forest Service campground with a big concrete tank under them.
So you say they only clean it once a year. What was that when you knew that going into it?
Yeah, I knew about them. I knew how they worked. And
What were your thoughts?
Well, that's why I picked it. After I killed whoever, I was waiting for someone who was pretty small because I was going to dump them down in the tank. It was a really dark tank. They probably wouldn't have been found for a year or something. I don't know.
So basically, that's him talking candidly, I guess you can say, about his first crime that he may have been proud about because of the way he chats about it and kind of laughs about it in parts. As it said, the identity of the female was never released because she never actually went to the police. So this is right before his family moved again. This time they moved to New York, to a town called Constable. In Constable, it is about a 2-hour drive to the Canadian border. And Israel actually stated that he did visit Montreal to meet sex workers and to get into trouble. Basically, it's also known that on these Montreal trips, when he was 17 and 19, he actually had guns with him. He actually had knives. He had rope to bound somebody. He was basically ready to go if he found the right person, it seemed like. But he never confesses or gives us a belief that there is victims in Canada yet. We are definitely going to come back to talking about Canada because there is a lot more to Israel's travels when we talk about his timeline, I believe in episode 2. So let's actually get to the last and most important victim. I also want to add every victim of his is important. But this is the case that got him caught. So let's start. On the evening of February 2nd, 2012, 18-year-old Samantha Koenig was working at Common Ground Coffee Shop in Anchorage, Alaska. The coffee shop was actually chosen because of its location and the fact that it's actually open till about 8 or 9 o'clock, which is much later than most others in the area. This coffee shop, I looked at a couple different pictures of it and where it's at, and it's basically located on a busy street. There is an intersection. It is right at, and there's stoplights right there, right in front of this coffee shop. The coffee shop itself is, if you ever see pictures, which we do have in our pictures file for this episode, it is a small blue, I would say food truck sized shop, maybe a little bit bigger than a food truck, but it is extremely small.
It was
a camping trailer, a small family camping trailer.
Yeah, I would say, yeah. That's about the size
of it. Okay, yeah, that might be the best. But I was watching the video, and when I watched this 11-minute video, because there was a short video of Israel actually entering the coffee shop, but the long video, it is pretty intense. So basically in the video, you see Israel, he's walking across the parking lot, and he approaches the coffee shop, and it's basically a walk-up type of deal. So he walks up to the window, and he orders an Americano. And Samantha turns around and begins making the drink. So I was looking at the different angles in the video, and you can clearly see multiple vehicles like stopped at the stoplight right there in front of the like video, just kind of in the background. So to say that there was eyes on this location was a huge understatement. There was actually traffic going in and out of the parking lot itself. And she still somehow managed to be taken. So Samantha is making his coffee. She puts the lid on. She gives him the coffee. And he says something, maybe about asking for napkins or something. But she turns back around to grab something off the counter. And as she comes back to greet Israel, you see her and she's taken aback. Her hands go up in the air, and you can vaguely see something inside the window that's being pointed at her. It's actually a gun he did pull on her. He is standing outside of the coffee shop and he orders her to turn off the lights inside the shop, and she listens. She's in the dark and he tells her to get down onto the floor and lock the door. So she crawls back to the back of the shop, locks the door, and Israel then jumps in through the window and is hovering over her.
Okay, that was my question, because I did see this video.
Yeah.
And it was too dark. I couldn't tell how he got in. It looked like he got in by the door, but it was a window.
I thought it was the window. I thought he had pulled himself through the window.
But I couldn't tell if it was a window or like the door to the.
I have it that when she's going to the back to lock or unlock something, I don't know if she's locking the door or unlocking the door. But we actually, there's in the one video I did see, we actually have the back door footage, and I don't see him come in through the back door.
No, so assuming, it was like a side kind of view, wasn't it?
Exactly. It was very hard to tell exactly how he got in, but I think he pulled himself through the window. It just made the most sense because later in the video, they exit out the back of the shop. So I would have thought maybe we would have seen the door open and he come through it, but we'd never seen that. We just seen him in there randomly. So basically, while he's in the shop, he is rummaging around. I'm assuming he's possibly robbing the place, but it's hard to tell. So he demands money, and he also zip ties Samantha's hands. He asks her, more so demands, that she puts on her coat, and she does. And he says he asks her where her car is. She replies that she doesn't have one. Her boyfriend is actually picking her up. So at gunpoint, we actually see them both exit through the back door. They turn left towards the street. So basically, they're coming out onto the side street, and they come around the front where people order. So they walk that way in front. But it is said that right before they exited, like seconds, someone pulled away from the coffee shop. So a car pulled into the driveway, hovered there for a minute or two, and then actually took off minutes, if not like seconds, before they walked out. So she is at gunpoint, and they walk out, and they walk by the street. They pass out. Sorry. They pass by the ordering window, and they walk to his vehicle, which he parked in a nearby parking lot between IHOP and Dairy Queen. He used his white work truck, which he removed the license plates, all the toolboxes and tools that he had. So basically, he's making it look like a white truck, and they're not going to be looking for a work truck, basically. So he really thought it through when it came to his vehicle. In the video, one of the things we don't see as they're walking away, Samantha broke free and tried to run away from Keys. It still blows my mind, and watching the video and watching him kidnap her, and they walk out and there's cars going by. She broke away from him and he tackled her to the ground. I'm like,
and he was like kind of a little shit too, wasn't he? Like, he wasn't very big.
He's actually 6 foot and 180 pounds, so he was much bigger than I actually thought.
Oh, I thought, he didn't look that big.
No, he does. Like, in the pictures that you see of him, he doesn't look that threatening. He looks very small and lengthy, but
they said kind of the same thing about Ted Bundy too. Some of his victims that lived said he was very charming and like witty, and he was kind of able to change his looks to match what personality he wanted that day.
Exactly.
Their adrenaline starts to rush when they start committing these crimes, so they get like super strength from adrenaline.
Oh, I got you. Okay.
So maybe he was just so amped up, right? And he was able to take her down because his adrenaline was rushing. Like, I can't let her get away.
Exactly.
Now I have to kill her because she'd be a witness to what I'm trying to do.
So basically, his whole plan was to kill someone regardless. But this was not known to Samantha. He actually was telling Samantha that she needs to cooperate. This is just going to be, she's holding her for ransom. She's going to be able to go back to her family. So he forces her into the truck as he's trying to, you know, calm her down, and basically says that the gun that he has, that he's holding her hostage with, is a special gun with special quiet type of ammo, that if she tries to escape again, he'll have to kill her. So he's driving Samantha all around town because he's trying to wait for his family to actually fall asleep, which is fucked up in the first place. So Samantha just kept talking and talking and telling Keys that they're not going to get much in ransom. Her family's not that rich. Their family's more on the poor side, and going on and on. And he basically said that the community will raise this money for you. The community will be there for you to get you this money. Basically, she was convinced to cooperate.
Well, he was so intelligent, though. I feel like there was a lot of probably emotional blackmail and manipulation behind that. So
exactly.
She was probably just so afraid she would have done anything.
So as with the talking and talking, this girl, as we jump back to that girl Israel raped when he was 17, the reason he didn't kill her was because she seen his face, and she kept saying, basically, you're not a bad looking guy. If you asked me out, I would have loved to have gone out with you. And he goes on to explain that it seemed like at one point she thought, what would happen if I ever was to be raped? Like, if the situation happened, how would I react? And he got that feeling from this girl, and that's what eventually caused him to basically chicken off. The girl said she would never tell anyone, it'll be their secret, and basically that's when he ran off. So he did the exact same thing, I want to say, with Samantha, but this time, I forgot where I was going with that.
Convincing
her to cooperate because he's not going to harm her.
Right.
Okay, so Israel, realizing that Samantha didn't have a car, he ended up using his truck, which he wasn't planning on using in the first place. He asked Samantha if he had her cell phone, and she actually said she forgot it at work. So he actually drives back to the coffee shop, breaks in, leaving Samantha bound in his truck, steals her phone, gets back into the truck, and leaves and drives away. Back in the truck, he asks where her ID is, where her debit card. And once again, she actually doesn't have it with her. She's just going to work. She's not planning on doing anything afterwards. Her boyfriend was picking her up, so she kept her wallet in her boyfriend's car. Israel Keys then convinced her to give up her address, and then, realizing his family, his daughter, and his girlfriend had fallen asleep, he placed Samantha into a shed in front of the house. He gagged her, left her bound, turned on a little bit of heat, and left. He used a police scanner to see and convince her that if she escapes, he will know. He's got a police scanner, so if they hear of a kidnapping, he's going to be the first one to know, basically. To kind of scare her into just not doing anything, just sitting there. It worked. Israel drove his truck to Samantha's boyfriend's place, also her father's house. Israel breaks into the boyfriend's truck, and as he's searching and grabbing her debit card, Samantha's boyfriend happens to look out the window, notices someone in the truck, comes outside yelling, and then goes running back in, obviously to get Samantha's father. And they both come back out, and when they come back out, no one is there. It's just a simple break and enter. They didn't report this crime to the city, because when Samantha's boyfriend went to the truck and looked, he didn't actually realize that anything is missing. So he's like, someone just was looking through it. From what he can tell, he didn't notice that anything was missing, which was weird. Like, the whole family had done some weird, questionable things during this time, and they originally were not deemed suspects, as they were just acting erratically because they were worried. Israel has actually commented saying that he made his first mistake when he took Samantha from the coffee shop, in which was the same town he lived in. He's actually known for traveling thousands of miles to commit his killings. So the fact that he kidnapped and killed someone in his front yard, he realized that he made the mistake right then and there. It was too late at this time, though. Israel went to the bank. He tried Samantha's bank card because, once again, he convinced her to give him her PIN. It did work, so he returned home back to Samantha. Israel had already planned not to let her go. He entered back into the shed. He sexually assaulted and raped Samantha before strangling her to death. He left her in the shed, went back into the house he shared with his girlfriend, and went to bed. He woke up that next morning, finished packing for his 2-week-long trip from New Orleans, and left with his family that same day he killed Samantha. He returned back on February 17th to Alaska. He made a pit stop So the whole 2 weeks, he didn't spend it on a 2 week cruise. He went for a quick 1 week trip, and then he happened to stop at his mother's in Texas. And that's where he stayed for about a week. In the later episodes, we will actually go back to this because, as we know right now, of Israel telling this story, this is his only victim. We've not actually learned of any other victims. This is his first murder, just a simple murder that happened. He returns back home from Alaska on the 17th, and he immediately begins preparing Samantha's body for ransom. So basically, what the hell is that supposed to mean? She's dead. How are they going to get ransom for a dead person?
So he kept her in the shed, presumably.
Yes.
For a week?
2 weeks.
Or two.
2 weeks.
While he traveled.
Exactly. So it being Alaska in February, he didn't have to worry about decomposition setting in that quick because of the cold. She would be frozen and safe, basically.
So the weird thing is to me, though, like, his girlfriend didn't go in the back.
So they had an actual, they had like a garage attached to their house, but then they also had like a small shed. And I'm going to assume this is like his tool shed, like the man shed, you know?
Oh, yeah. Well, yeah.
So that's why I'm going to believe she never accidentally stumbled upon it.
Okay, that makes sense.
So what he did to prepare Samantha's body, he bought a newspaper that was about 2 days old. He propped her dead body up, sewing her eyes open to make it look like she is alive, and then took a picture of her and the newspaper and sent that off. Before he actually released the ransom letter, that is when he dismembered Samantha's body. He drove out to Matanuska Lake, where he cut open a hole in the ice and placed her body in the water. He took the ransom note for $30,000 and the photo that was placed that he took inside. He took the ransom note for $30,000 and the photo he had taken, placed both inside a bag, and put it at Connor's Bog Park under a memorial flyer for a dog named Albert. So he didn't really put it anywhere. He just kind of like posted it to one of those bulletin boards as walking by, right? And then he called Samantha's boyfriend and texted him and informing of where the letter would be found. There's actually on our Instagram, I did post a little sneak peek of that of the text message that Israel sent Samantha's boyfriend. It was pretty much was saying, oh, she's pretty. Ransom note at Connor's Bog Park. Basically, it was all that was written. Samantha's family, being unaware that she's dead, was able to gather the funds and deposited the $30,000 reward money into Samantha's account, which was connected to her card. This is when the police set in a plan to hopefully try and catch whoever had actually kidnapped Samantha. 1 week following the ransom note, Israel made another mistake, and this mistake is the one that led to his capture. On February 29th and March 1st, 2012, Israel withdrew three separate amounts at three different ATMs, all within 1 hour period. These transactions were obviously immediately flagged because they were deemed suspicious, right? The hunt was on. They had an idea of where he was going because he was stopping. They knew he was traveling east in Texas. 2 days later, on March 3rd, Keyes actually began posting on a KTVA article about Samantha's missing kidnapping. He posted, and what we believe is him, something like this. I hate to say this. At this point, there is no hope. And I would like to point out, innocent until proven guilty. stupid people like to blame others because he sounds like a prime suspect without any proof that they actually did it. And she wasn't so innocent either. The dumb bitch played others' emotions and with this guy, and she has a boyfriend. So you have to wonder about the consequences. I really wish she found lessons learned. So that one was a very vague, it was a random weird comment. It made absolutely no sense to me. There was also quite a few posts under the name of Is Reyes IK, Izzy is real, his name being spelt wrong. One from Is Real had said on Friday, March 2nd, nothing surprises me anymore. For every action, there's a reaction. And playing with other people's emotions, male or female, is a very vile thing. Also, I have to say, people who portrayed an image or a personality trait up front and isn't the type of person that they say they are, you are only hurting yourselves. So these two comments, people really think that Israel wrote these. The FBI had mentioned that these two were quotes and comments that they did believe Israel made. Like they said, they had no proof because Israel sometimes used public computers. So he would go to a library, or if he was at a coffee shop and they had computers, he would use those to write these comments and make these little digs. So Israel got invited to his sister's wedding. He and his daughter flew down to Las Vegas around March 7th, 2012. They stayed at the Riviera Hotel for about 2 days before making their way from Las Vegas to Texas. Israel rented a white Ford Focus, and he kept that Ford Focus for the dates of March 7th all the way until March 21st. He's headed to Willcox, Arizona first. Here, he stopped at Western Bank and made several withdrawals. So basically, this is withdrawal number four he made because he's already made three. This is his fourth. That same day in New Mexico, he made another withdrawal. At this point, the FBI knew Israel was traveling from west to east. They knew he was going from Arizona to New Mexico. From New Mexico, the next state is Texas. So on March 8th, Israel arrived in Lufkin, Texas, which was his mother's home. He traveled to a nearby city, Humble City, and made withdrawal number six at a Houston Community Bank. Israel booked a four-night stay at the Quality Inn Suites while he was in Lufkin, Texas. So on March 11th, he attended his sister's wedding. He traveled additionally 3.5 hours to make another withdrawal at 11:47 p.m. that same night. So about 5 days later, what Israel didn't know, he was actually being followed. The FBI and the bank were in contact, and they were tracing every withdrawal, and they were using the full system, full security system, to try and even find a vehicle. And they were able to find a vehicle. It was a Ford Focus. For some reason, they knew it was a rental. I don't know how, but they knew they narrowed it down to the rental company. The rental
company. Maybe they ran the plate.
They did not have plates for it yet. They just knew it was a white Ford Focus. So the police actually narrowed down two vehicles, one being the one Israel Keys rented and another being another random white Ford Focus that was rented out. Ultimately, it was Corporal Brian Henry of the Texas Highway Patrol who happened to pull over a white Ford Focus matching the description for speeding. It was Keys driving. Henry, along with Texas Ranger Steve Rayburn, obtained enough information from the traffic stop to actually do a search of the Ford Focus. Basically, what was vaguely found, we will go into our full details of what was found in a later episode, but they found enough. They found Samantha's cellular phone. They found her ATM card and her wallet. And her ATM card was actually in Israel's wallet as well. He was charged for credit card fraud and was extradited back from Texas to Anchorage, Alaska. On April 2nd, 2012, searchers found Samantha Koenig's body after Israel had mentioned where to find it. On April 18th, 2 weeks later, an Anchorage grand jury indicted Keyes for the kidnapping and murder of Samantha Koenig. While awaiting trial in the Anchorage jail, Keyes was interviewed for more than 40 hours by Anchorage detective Jeff Bell and FBI Special Agent Jolene Godin. Although he was not completely forthcoming with all his details, he did begin to confess some murders that he had committed over the past 14 years. In his interviews, Israel began toying and slowly playing a game of giving details just enough to get them questioning and wanting more, and then he would basically hold off. It was when he had mentioned that 14 years that he's been active that the FBI actually realized they had a serial killer in their hands.
Wow. This guy makes me speechless.
Like, this is not even the beginning of it. Like, right now, we don't even think he has a, not motive, like, a pattern. But as we learn in the future, he actually does somewhat have a pattern out there. So what we know, he likes to commit a murder, and then he still is on a high, an adrenaline high from that murder. He normally would go out and rob a bank and commit an arson.
Wow. So something really extreme.
So when the FBI made their timeline, they went back and said, you know, Israel was in this town for 2 days or whatnot. Was there any raw bank robbings that happened within that month or 2 months? 1 month prior, 1 month after, as well, was there any arson? Was there any arson fires that had occurred? And it was here when they did begin to notice, you know what? We are finding a killing, a bank robbing, a murder. So he did actually have a little bit of a, I forgot the word again. Pattern going.
Wow. Wow. No wonder we need three parts.
Four.
Four. That's all I have to say.
Right. Right. So I do have another audio that I am going to play. It is Israel basically talking and saying that, he's two different people, and anyone who claims to know him knows nothing. So here we go. Oh, this is not it.
Contained his relationship.
Here we go.
Right now, there is no one who knows me or who has ever known me who knows anything about me, really. Mm-hmm. They know they're going to tell you something that does not line up with anything I tell you because I'm two different people, basically. And the only person who knows about what I'm telling you, the kind of things I'm telling you, is me.
How long have you been two different people?
Long time. 14 years.
And basically, that was then, with that comment, 14 years of being two different people, they realized that they had themselves a serial killer, unknowingly.
And I think it's called identity something disorder. What's the name of it? can't think of it, but basically, yeah, that's what it means.
Oh, okay, gotcha. I don't think I've ever heard of that one yet.
I'll think of it. Give me a second. All right, let me look it up real quick. I have to correct myself here. keep going.
That is actually the end of episode one.
Wow, that was like deep, man.
Right? Episode two is going to get a little bit more.
That was disturbing. I kind of liked it. You know what I mean?
Right? Right? It was pretty interesting enough to keep you drawn in. Like, now that we know he's a serial killer, what's going to happen next? What are we going to learn?
It's like dun, dun, dun.
Yeah. Where's the story going to take us? It's going to take us back and forth from the past to the future, talking about everyone who's ever known him, anyone who's ever come in contact with him, not anything he's ever done. That's one thing we will never know.
Never, because he's dead.
He's dead before he was able to commit. I don't know what I was going to say with that. He already committed these crimes before he could give all these other families possible closure, because he mentions that he did know pretty much everyone's name who he had killed. He has said he had done less than a dozen bank robberies, less than a dozen arsons, less than a dozen murders. But the thing is, maybe he means more than a dozen. A dozen is the most you will ever find information on him of, but there's more out there
that they potentially do not know about yet.
And now can't.
Well, unless they have a sample of his DNA and something came up, like a hit. Like if they found bones or something.
He did end his life, and he did cut his wrists, and he hung himself. So I would think that they would have had that DNA.
I'm sure they would have swabbed Samantha, or maybe not, because if she was in the water, most of that DNA would be completely washed away.
Exactly. You're so
but right, you never that. Know. It only takes, you know, like one lucky break. You know what I mean?
Yes. Oh, definitely. It
usually waters the tiebreaker, but I hope they did, just so they can match him up with different victims that come up.
So when he died, apparently he left either a hint to a location, and that location is Corozal in Central America. So I believe it's in a town or a village in Belize. And he left that hint, so we are going to assume that he did something when he was out there, committed a crime. But we will definitely look into that and learn a little bit more about those trips, some of the family trips, because as you will also learn as we're going through this case, a pattern of his was, oh, we're going to have a family trip. Oh, I'm going to go missing for 3 days. I'm just going to shut my phone off. You're not going to be able to contact me. And
oops.
sometimes not even letting people know. We just leave in the middle of the night, leave a note, and leave his daughter, for example.
Wow.
His daughter is aware of his crimes. She is now 18 years old. But she is not ready to look at all the information and actually know what he did. She's aware he's a serial killer, he killed himself, but besides that, she does not know much more information. She is interested, though, learning about it in the future. So I did think that was kind of interesting to a point.
That is interesting, actually. I think so.
Besides that, that is the end of today's part one episode of the Meticulous Killer Israel Keys special. In part two, we are going to go over a little bit more of Israel chatting with the FBI and his interviews. This next one, I am going to have probably about 10 audio clips for us to hear. He talks about his daughter. He talks about having no specific person, victim in mind, just basically going after someone he can overpower.
Okay, that makes sense.
He also goes into talking about, we do see him toying with the FBI. He gives two bodies and a name. That's an exact quote. He does say, I will give you two bodies and a name. And then we actually will go into those two people and their deaths, because those are the two people we know of. Three people. I did learn today that one of the podcasters does claim to FBI is 100% positive they have a fourth victim, a fourth known victim that they can attribute to Keys, which I will add, I think that one will be in episode three. I'll talk about that lady. I'll give you that much. I'll give you one gender, a lady. And then also we will chat about what was found on... I could technically do that now. I didn't want to put the audio. I wanted to write out what was actually found on him, because it wasn't like an FBI interview detailing this information. It was what the podcaster had collected from whoever was able to give him some of these FBI files.
Yeah.
So I want to go through, listen to what he says, and kind of just like jot down a list of things and then kind of say it that way in my own, because I don't want to be pulling audio clips of him. I don't want to copyright him. These interview clips, so be it.
Excuse me, I'm tired.
Oh, I know. Oh, I bet.
Ugh. I'm completely looking forward to part two. I'm literally not even researching anything because I want to be surprised. I want to have genuine reactions.
Perfect. Like, the more I go in, I'm like, oh, there's more information. I have the last few. I think I have like 10 or less more podcast episodes to listen to, just to fine tune the last of my notes. Just because when I went through and they chatted about Canada, yeah, there was a bit of information. They did talk about some potential missing people in Canada, but I want to give my opinion on what happened in Canada, what could have happened in Canada, because there was a lot. And randomly, this part is going to be edited out. We're probably going to edit like a last 10 minutes of this out, probably. But
probably.
In Canada, when they heard that Israel Keys was looking at picking up hookers when he was like 19, that was around the year that Robert Picton, the pig farmer from Vancouver, from Port Coquitlam, was caught. So they had all these news articles about missing sex workers, only from Vancouver area, because that's where they were all missing. Over 80 missing women, I believe it was, possibly more. And they could find no missing sex workers in Montreal during that time. There was no articles because everything was in a frenzy over this Robert Picton during the time, which I thought was a pretty interesting thing. The timing happened to be right. These could have been his first victims, Canadian sex workers.
That's an interesting, what do you call that, lead?
Right?
That's so, I can't wait to hear part two. I'm psyched already. I'm totally ready for it.
Part two is so good. I'm like, I just went through my notes and I'm like, is there anything I could add? Could I just like go on for another like 15 minutes about something along the same line? And I'm like, no, not right now. I don't want to get into it.
Not right now.
That's going to be used for like a later episode.